Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton. And today, I'm joined by curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher and programmer of the Eastern Promises film series, Eastern You. It's hard to adapt a book to a film. Short stories often make better movies because they contain less that needs to be expressed in the film. Books also often have the voice of a narrator, which can be impossible to replicate within the world, unless voiceover is used, or another convention. One of my favorite examples where I prefer the movie to the book is High Fidelity, where they give John Cusack's character the power to address the camera and drive the narrative. Today, we're going to look at two films that are book adaptations that not only have distinctive narrative voices within the books, they aren't the first, nor will they be the last adaptations of these stories. But before we get into that, Eastern, what to you makes a successful book adaptation?
I thought about this last night, and truly what makes a great film adaptation is that the filmmaker has a deep grasp of the film form. It's simple as that. I don't think being faithful to the book necessarily succeeds in making a great adaptation. I think you need to know how to make a great film. And you use the book as definitely the map. And yes, you want to be faithful mostly. And I did say no, but you know, David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch is an exception to that in many ways.
Certainly
and
is.
Succeeds as a film, right? So, you know, you have that and then, but, you know, if we were to talk about Narnia, like, I feel like that movie, you know, I've learned it's a very faithful adaptation, but does it succeed as a film? I don't know if it does necessarily, and we can talk about that. So I think through this discussion of Narnia, we will learn what really makes an adaptation succeed.
I think you're right. Alicia, do you have any favorite adaptations that you're like, this worked for me?
Bram Stoker's Dracula by Francis Ford Coppola, which definitely is not a faithful,
that.
I mean, in some ways it's the most faithful of adaptations because it brings back the epistolary format to the story, which is all being written in letters and telegrams and things like that. But then it also mashes in, you know, a century of vampire lore and brings a love story into the film that's only hinted at in the book, that's not really there, brings in sex. But to me, somehow what it got was the whole vibe, the whole mood, the whole attraction to Dracula and put that on screen. And so therefore it is a faithful adaptation.
And it's the film form. It's the mise-en-scene. It's the mood. It's the mode.
Yeah. It turns out Francis Ford Coppola, most of the time, knows how to make a film.
Exactly.
Like, I love that film so much.
Like 75%.
The director has to it has to be in their heart and their soul and in their blood.
They need to love the book too. And I think when we go to talk about Chronicles of Narnia, the first film, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I don't see this director's love of this story at all.
When you look at movies where there's a series of books and multiple different directors and the different points of view, although it's meant to be one big whole, I'm thinking specifically of like the Harry Potter films, it's interesting to see which one of them has magic in it. And I think that's something we're also going to be talking about with Narnia and which ones don't. So like, I think about the early ones, which were directed by Christopher Columbus, like the first one, there's no magic in that movie because they're so concerned about setting up the world and who these characters are that they don't take the time. But like, then you'd have like a 4.5 hour long movie for children. So how do you then kind of combine those two things if you're doing this like big expansive world? And the only way to do it, I guess, is television series. If you're looking at something that expands.
Did either of us grow up with the BBC 1988 Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, like I think possibly four part. Specifically, I can remember the sound of the wheels on the audiovisual cart being rolled into the classroom and being, oh baby, we're going to be eating Turkish delight in no time. We watched that every year, twice a year. I don't even know. Like, I grew up with that. And it was, I think I loved it. I would be really curious to rewatch it. I think I had that kind of perception of that apparently was a kind of a great adaptation, even though it didn't have the technology, which in 2005 we do, and it's not a great adaptation.
It's often something that I am always very hesitant if I have read the book to see the movie, because I've got a very vivid imagination and I'm always very concerned that what I have in my head is going to be different than what's on the screen, and the choices they make are going to be different. The only exception I have to that, and I think that's what makes Stephen King so magical and special, is that you can put so many different interpretations on his prolific works, and some of them work and some of them don't, but they're always something unique and special. So I think about something like Misery. I think about something like The Mist. I think about Carrie. You know, even we talked about Stand By Me, Christine, right? I mean, Rob Reiner just knows how to do adaptations, obviously. That's what he's doing. Same with Frank Darabont, right? Some people just get it and they know how to find the cores of those stories.
So I'm curious, Eastern, have you thought about what your favorite page to screen adaptation is?
Well, you know, I confess I haven't read that many books that have gone into an adaptation. I think you mentioned Becky High Fidelity. That was one of my favorite movies as I was growing up in my teenage years, just feeling rejected and just feeling like someone did mention, it's like, oh, you're like John Cusack, because I was just like, my arms were around and I was just very eccentric, charismatic and all that. But I was never getting the lady. So that movie was like, Catcher in the Rye, you know what I mean? Like, it was like my mirror movie, right? It was just like, I wanted to work at Suspect Video. I wanted to work at a cool record store. I really like fell in love with being a nerd and, you know, just wallowing in my interiority. But, and so then I did read the book and was pleasantly surprised that they both are like a beautiful balance with each other. And the book is different in some ways, but the essence of both is so similar. So that succeeded. Oh, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. Okay. Guess what, you guys? So I remember reading that book because I'm not a big, you know, I just picked it up. And Mordecai Richler, I just heard of him. He was just like this old, you know, Montreal writer. Fine, cool. And then I couldn't stop reading that book. And I finished it in the night. Or like in 2 days. And I laughed my ass off, especially in the description of the wedding film. And it was written like a screenplay. I remember just bursting into laughter and then watching the movie in his town hall on 35mm, because somehow we got a print of it. I was amazed by, what's his name? From Jaws,
Richard Dreyfuss. It's one of his greatest performances.
He's so
young. You know, he actually talked a little shit about that movie. He said it was a bad movie.
He more than that. Okay, he refused to acknowledge it. He did not do it. Sorry, I interviewed Ted Kotcheff about that movie, so I know a lot about Duddy Kravitz, because it's one of my favorites as well. I'm so glad you brought it up. But he talked so much shit about it. He refused to do any press. He disowned it. And then the reason why he did Jaws was he was terrified his career was over. So he originally said no to Jaws, and then he saw some of the screeners from Duddy Kravitz and went, oh shit, my career is over. I better take something quick so that people forget about this. He called up Steven Spielberg and says, yeah, I'll do your movie. So he did Jaws because
that's
of Duddy Kravitz.
Amazing. I mean, I can't believe that we all three love that movie. I've never met another person who loves that movie. Was amazed.
It's
and
so
going
special.
Back to that wedding scene in the movie, it's like it felt verbatim, and I was laughing my ass off in the theater just like when I was laughing when I was reading it. So I think from page to screen, having not read that many books because I spent time watching movies, that was an excellent adaptation.
I think you're pretty well read. I think you're not giving yourself, I know you pretty well, Eastern. You're not giving yourself enough credit. I'm not sure you're aware of how little the average person reads. It is an incredibly depressing
statistic. If Alicia
reads
at an 8, Becky a 9, Eastern will read at like a 5, and then.
But 5 is probably still better than the 2 that the average person is bringing to the game.
I mean, I tell you, right now, if we want to talk about adaptations, I think I'm now reading Dune after watching the movie, and I'm very surprised because I do the retroactive reading, right? And really surprised about while I'm reading it, I'm now seeing the decisions that Denis Villeneuve has made in his movie. And it goes back to my whole thesis about adaptations are run by auteurs who have a calling to tell this story. I can see the economic efficiencies that he's making, condensing scenes into just one lines or moments into the film, but it's the mise-en-scene. It's the mood, it's the tone, it's the vision, the cinema that makes Dune a great adaptation of the book. It's not, did I get all these characters in? Are they doing this? Are we paying attention to the plot? Are we doing all that?
Do we need to send people a glossary so they understand what to do?
And adding sound design to that mix is something a book can never really do. And I think, you know, no matter what you think of Dune, and I actually was quite satisfied by it, that sound design and the way that the landscape is designed through audio is incredible. And it is Dune. It somehow is Dune, even though when you're reading the book, obviously you can't hear the sounds.
Well, Eastern, I'm really glad that you brought up points of view and having a love of the films, because I think we're going to see that a lot in the two films that we're talking about today. So let's get into our first one. So The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe has had four screen adaptations already. The first was a 10-part miniseries for the BBC in 1967. The second was an animated film from 79, directed by Peanuts' own Bill Melendez, which got a heavy rotation in my own childhood. And the third was a BBC movie which featured live-action animatronics and some animation. Oh, and nightmarish beaver-human hybrids. It would take until 2005, and let's face it, the budget of Disney and the advancement of CGI to bring the story to the big screen. Now, the story is a dark one for children, but the three previous versions did their best to make it fun and accessible. The 2005 version, however, opens with the bombing of London and the children scrambling for a bunker, letting the audience know this ain't gonna be your granddaddy's Narnia, or your daddy's for that matter. Eastern, do you have any particular attachment to the Narnia stories?
Nope, I do not, but I'm watching Narnia through the lens that I am the biggest fan of C.S. Lewis's last fictional novel, Till We Have Faces. And apparently it's a novel where people who dislike Narnia or don't care for Narnia are absolute lovers and worship Till We Have Faces, which is his, it's completely different. So I'm watching this, and as I'm watching Narnia, I'm kind of seeing that, you know, people grow and become different. So that's the, sorry for the tangent there, but no, I'm not attached to Narnia whatsoever. They didn't play it in my schools when I was young, so I got nothing. So watching it as an adult, impatiently, there's nothing there for me.
Sorry, apologies.
Oh boy. Well, no, I appreciate that. But I think it's also important sometimes to look at things and go, because I don't think this is a successful adaptation as well. Alicia, I know you don't. But I think what's really interesting about this movie, and part of why we're talking about it, is why not? Why doesn't this work? And why did the series, which was planned to be huge and epic, peter out?
It's like a relationship, like online dating. Like on paper, you might be a 99% match and like all of your interests are aligned and you're attracted to each other. And then when in real life, when you just go to try to figure out what that chemistry is, it's just not there. And there's no real reasoning why, although I think there's a lot of reasons why this doesn't work. And that's the intentions of the filmmakers. But yeah, the chemistry, the magic, the world is just flat.
So before we get into that, if someone has somehow not seen The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's fine if you have not seen, you know, Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That's okay. You don't need to have that on your list. But Alicia, do you want to give us a quick plot summary of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, please?
There's a lion. There's a witch. You meet them by going through a wardrobe. This is actually the second book in C.S. Lewis's Narnia, Chronicles of Narnia. So the first one is The Magician's Nephew. But I understand why Disney would stick to this film first, because I know when we were reading this as a kid, you always would gravitate towards Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and maybe go back to Magician's Nephew, but probably rarely.
So weirdly, the Magician's Nephew is actually the sixth book. This is the sixth or the seventh book that was written, but this was the first book that was released. This is the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe's first book that was written. So there's like a weird chronological jumping that happens. Does that make sense? Yes.
Yes.
Who's on first? I don't know.
So I think at a certain point when they like renumbered the stories, probably in the 80s or 90s for a new generation, book number one was Magician's Nephew, regardless of that being published much, much later. And the story takes place earlier. None of this is neither here nor there. It just does not matter. But this is a story of the Pevensies children, four of them, very British name, who are, you know, in the Blitz, and England basically shipped their children off into the countryside, and they were fostered by volunteer families in rural areas to try to protect them from being killed by the bombs. They put little like Paddington Bear tags on the kids and stick them on a train. And then they get off on a platform at a place that they've never been to before. And it's some sort of professor who's going to take them in this like sprawling estate and this very dusty old home that happens to have a wardrobe. While playing hide and seek, the littlest girl, Lucy, goes to hide in the wardrobe and is transported to Narnia, where she finds out that humans are kind of illegal through Mr. Tumnus, here played by James McAvoy, and sporting very bad CGI goat legs. And essentially the White Witch is known as Jaden. I think it's Jaden or Jadis.
Jadis.
Jadis. Needs to kill the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve in order to retain her control over this ever-long winter world. And if she doesn't, it's slowly going to start to spring, turn to spring and to summer. And Aslan the lion, who was originally going to be Brian Cox, and all I can picture is him saying fuck off to every single like Alice Succession, which is funny because we also have a Succession actor in Pride and Prejudice, which completely skewed my understanding of that film. Aslan's going to fight the, you know, there's battles. There's not that many battles in the book. This becomes like a Lord of the Rings somehow through Disneyfication. Yeah, I don't know. It's filmed in Auckland. It looks good sometimes, but most of the time it doesn't. And I think I don't love hating on films for this podcast, but I really hate this film because I loved these books so much. And I grew up on that BBC 1988 miniseries. And I think this is just an incredible disappointment.
Because 2001 is the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that one, they also didn't start with The Hobbit. They started with The Lord of the Rings. So it's interesting that like you're kind of jumping forward in these stories and you're pushing people into like into the world in a different way where you're not giving them the introductory. You need to know who Bilbo is. You need to know who the magician is, right? Or who the magician's nephew is, the Jim Broadbent character in this. Like you just kind of wink at it. And you need to know that all of the movies were planned as a series and that Disney was on board for all seven working with Walden Media. However, they stopped after the third one because there was just diminishing returns for this. The second one, Prince Caspian, made half of what this one did. And then the next one made half of that. Like, it's just, it was not worth it.
That being said, the three films in combination made $1.5 billion worldwide. So that's just how insane the margin is on films like this for a company like Disney. Like, you would think $500 million each when you divide is a good profit, and Disney's like, not enough. It's not enough to justify continuing this story.
I think what's difficult for me though, and stop me if you guys think I'm wrong, is that one of the things that doesn't work for me is they haven't figured out who this movie is for. So they're trying to make it for older kids, because when you open it up, and I was so shocked by that opening where it starts in a German bomber and then they're bombing London and then you watch the kids run, and I'm just like, this is horrifying.
Which is not in the book at all, where we start the book on the train. Yeah.
And in the book, like, it's insinuated, because you would know what that was when C.S. Lewis was writing these. You would know why the kids were going to get away from the bombings. However, in 2005, we're so far away from that, I wonder if they had to remind people this was the emergency situation. These kids had to be sent away to strangers. So they were like, here's the stakes of why these kids are gone. But then it turns, like, Narnia into almost a trauma fever dream. Like, it's very weird.
I think the execution was just simply not satisfying for me. I'm okay with starting the movie with German bombs in London for context. I was just, you know, kind of appalled by the CGI airplanes at the very beginning, and there was just no sense of delicacy or nuance in that direction. And all I could see, once I saw the boy looking out the windows fascinated by the fireworks display of the bombs, I was like, you should have started the scene there. You should have started like the mom looking worried and concerned. Don't start with ghastly CGI. And being post Lord of the Rings, I think Weta worked on this, right?
They did everything.
Yeah, and after Lord of the Rings, they had this sense. There was a lot of hubris. There was a lot of arrogance in their CG work, and they're just like, we can do anything. It felt like, and it was like, no, you need to relearn storytelling and not depend on CGI in 2005, especially.
You need to study the anatomy of goats more
and the minotaurs. I think there's so many minotaurs.
The legs on James McAvoy, because I'll buy him as Mr. Tumnus, sure, from the waist up. I guess I was halfway there, and then as soon as that camera scrolled down, I was like, what nightmare is this? Like, this is, and I know that Weta was looking at Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights, which I think is a really interesting reference point as a painting. I mean, for I'm sure all of our listeners know that painting, but think about, you know, the guys with the flutes up their butts and stuff like that. I love that that's the reference, but I don't see that in this film. I don't see that surrealism or that anarchy or that messiness, which frankly, I want some messiness. Everything is too, as you say, Eastern, clean and CGI'd and like still somehow looks imperfect.
And you know, the way they introduced the mother, I just felt her performance was so stale. I felt like that just, yeah. We didn't give her a glance, a moment. She was acting worried without being the mother worried, you know? And
you can say that for the kids too. Like, you don't spend enough time with the kids. Like, one of the reasons that I know Harry Potter is very controversial right now, but one of the reasons we love the Harry Potter books is because it's easy to relate to all of those children. I think the other reason why children love these C.S. Lewis books, because they are dealing with children. It's from their point of view, and they are in danger, but not in danger at the same time. It's a very hard balance to ride, even though the stakes are very high. Here, you never actually feel like the kids are in danger, and you don't like the kids particularly much. The kids don't get much to do.
No, and it, you know, it, so many things come into play to make a great work, right? So like Alicia had said, it's kind of like dating. It's like we have the checklist. Like, this movie has Weta. Like, dude, Weta just owned the world with Lord of the Rings with special effects. Like, you know, we all know that or we don't know, but I read, or Becky, you told me that C.S. Lewis never wanted a film adaptation of this because it would look like complete buffoonery,
like creatures,
and he was right. Well, he in this one, it was like, we're 70% there, we're almost not buffoonery, but alas, we entered buffoonery. And I think there's so many elements to make a movie that you may have. You have a cast, you have the budget, you have Weta behind you, but you know, let's say like it is, Andrew Adamson, did he have a heart for this story, you know, or was this just a job? I think this was his second feature film. You know, if you...
Well, should we just say that he comes from animation and his first film is Shrek.
Right.
Like, that's his debut. So he's coming from a totally different world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so there's nothing in his resume that says that he can do this job on a level of nuance and human character-driven piecing, you know? So, you know, and we talk about the goat legs, whatever, the lamb legs. If that was Guillermo del Toro, he would be obsessed with like the how those legs are made. And, you know,
and it was going to be del Toro, but he turned it down for Pan's Labyrinth. And good thing he did, because we required a Pan's Labyrinth at that time.
And we got better goat legs in that movie.
The best goat legs. I mean, if anything, this movie had great Turkish delight.
Okay, that was my question for you, because this actually traumatized me as a kid, because I grew up with this book and I always wanted to try Turkish Delight. Living in Mississauga in the 80s, Turkish Delight was not really at the grocery store. Like, I would have had to go to a specialty store, but my dad traveled to Istanbul for business and brought me back Turkish Delight. And I can remember taking a bite and just being like, oh, why? What? What is this? Like, this is garbage. And now I think as an adult, I like it a bit more. But do either of you like Turkish Delight?
I've never had it. It looks so good.
I did. You've never had a big Turk?
No.
That's not Turkish. Okay, but that's not Turkish.
What was that thing?
No, we're talking about like the
sugary, like snowflakes on something.
It's
like
powdered. Yeah, it's like a gelatinous, usually rose water, pistachio potentially, covered in like a powdered sugar. And there would be no chocolate like in a big Turk scenario whatsoever. Yeah. And it's certainly not high fructose corn syrup.
Big Turk scenario.
You know what? This is it's a great metaphor for how out of touch we are with that era, right? And these kids. And these kids are just like, I'm like, I wrote something when I watched it. I said, if I had to hang out with these kids, at their age, if I was that old, if I was 9 and I had to hang out with these kids, I'd feel so left out and lonely. Like, I wouldn't get along with them. I wouldn't. Like, I just think that they're just like, ugh.
Yeah, I get that. And I mean, I guess the other thing to keep in mind, which is good that we have the Blitz contacts, like, obviously, sugar is rationed hugely in England. So these kids probably haven't had a sweet in like 2 years. Or if they had, it's very sparse. So you kind of, I love when Edmund digs into that like gooey. It looks like almost like a jelly donut. Like, I felt it, but I don't know. I think there's more to your point, Eastern, and I really like that. I love also, I'm sad that you wrote down that these kids would reject you.
No, I would reject them.
Yeah, that's
fair. I would fair. Reject yes. them.
Did you not listen to him talking about high fidelity? He wants to be the cool outsider. Yeah. That's what Eastern
I
is.
I think what this is also missing and what it convolutes is Britishness. This is a British yes. story. It's a British context. And the reason it didn't get made, despite Disney trying in the 90s, is because they were not convinced that British culture would translate to American audiences, and they wanted to start to set this film with American kids in the US, which was a horrible idea. And the only thing that really got this greenlit, as Becky mentioned, is because Harry Potter was such a huge success, it proved that British culture could be exported to like a children's franchise and get major, major dollars. But I still think they are half-assing the Britishness of this. Like, yes, these actors, for the most part, have British accents. I think all of them do, except for, I think they're all British. Maybe there's only one that, I can't remember who was the one non, oh, Ray Winstone as a beaver.
Oh, he from
is
the
British.
UK. He from the UK.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe he's Australian, because we just did the, I mean, if you liked Ray Winstone in The Proposition, let me tell you, Ray Winstone as Mr. Beaver. We did talk about the proposition.
You guys already did The Proposition. Where was
it? It's the next episode.
Wait.
Yeah. It's.
Oh, you already did it too. You just need a cameo with me. Like, I'll just like, what's the plot synopsis? Okay, well, let's hear what Eastern has to say, because I
should have thought about that for you. Yeah, it's our finale. So our finale is always Becky, Cam, Alicia, and I forced them to watch The Proposition. But then that meant I had to watch Wolf Creek. It was a bit of a, you know, eye for an eye.
I was literally thinking. Okay, anyway, yeah, go on, please.
Coming back to the Britishness, it's just not there. Yet. It's not there. The British whimsy, like, I think in the last 15 years or 16 years since this film came out, we know that things like Downton Abbey, like North America is obsessed with British culture, and it works really well at the box office, and it works really well for viewership. And I just wish they had doubled down a bit more on that world that C.S. Lewis created, with all the Turkish delight and all the strange, you know, UK like slang that we will not understand. I don't care. Like, I want that. I want a different world to fall into, and this is just not a real world to me.
And it didn't feel different enough from the two. Like, I want to see one of the. I grew up with the animation, and the animation is very clear. This is the real world. This is the magic world. There is danger here. There's danger here. It's just a different kind of danger. But like, it's very clear. And then the lamppost is the demarcation of that. Right? It's the guiding light home to get back to a place of safety. And at no point do you really feel like these kids are in danger here, even when they're in the middle of an epic battle. Because again, who is this for? So the battle is scaled back. It can't be like an orcs tearing each other up with giant machetes.
It's also
kind
rated
of thing,
PG,
right?
Which, or maybe even G. I mean, it's interesting. We've talked for 20 minutes and not even brought up that Tilda Swinton is in this, which is a brilliant act of casting, because who else could it be? But even in that case, where she looks phenomenal, costume's great, I don't buy it.
And she's not given enough to do.
I found her dreads offensive in 2022.
yes. It was also supposed to be Michelle Pfeiffer, but this was when she was on her hiatus. Who's like the other person? I'm like, okay, we saw her do an amazing witch in Stardust. She could have pulled that off.
Yeah.
But I mean, Tilda's just so otherworldly.
Yeah, you throw some contact lenses on her. I think she knew that this wasn't going well. And you can see the behind the scenes photos of the kids trying to act against a green screen. The wonder is completely flat. There is no wonder in this film. And I really wish it was Brian Cox as Aslan. I think Liam Neeson is fine, but I just kept thinking.
No, I thought he was miscast. I agree. I think Liam Neeson wasn't fine. I felt like when a voice doesn't fit or suit the character, it feels like it's out of sync for me. And I felt like that with him. I just needed a little bit more. I could go for Brian Cox. I would audition Cox.
Have you forgotten the laws upon which Narnia was built?
Do not cite the deep magic to me, witch. I was there when it was written.
Aslan's supposed to be both, he's gentle with the children, but he's meant to be scary. And Brian Cox would have delivered that, I think, really, really well if he could mind his P's and Q's. Who would you give it to, Eastern?
I'd give it to Idris Elba if we had to make this in 2022.
Yeah.
Agreed. But I think that's part of the complication of why this film doesn't work, is they're trying to simplify it too much for, like, they're trying to make it too much for kids. And having a small person of my own, it is important to traumatize children every now and then. Like, it's important to be like, you know, not soften things too much. And Aslan does scare the children initially. They are frightened of him. And at no point, again, the danger is not there. At no point are they like, are we supposed to trust this? He is a lion. Like, we are supposed to be afraid of lions. They are wild animals and they are killers. But that's not the case here. And he has to kind of gain their trust, and he understands that, right? So the moment when he's sacrificed by the White Witch and the girls cry over him, that's meant to be a turning point of them realizing what he has done for them, and they were afraid of him, and there's a mild amount of shame there. And I mean, that ties into the whole Jesus thing, right? Like, here's this person with like this phenomenal power that we are in awe of and frightened of, and then he makes the sacrifice for us, and only when he comes back do we truly appreciate who he is what he's going to do for us. Right? Like, it's, again, I'm not a religious person, but that's what the story is coming from. And that's the power of it.
I mean, and we know with there because C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, who were buddies, they were in a literary group called the Inklings, and quite close throughout their lives. Like, that religious iconography is there throughout the Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit. And it's certainly here just sort of distilled for children in Narnia. And I think that's another thing that Disney gets wrong, is that exactly what you're saying, Becky, that wondrousness of Aslan coming back to life because the children believe in him and because he's sacrificed. It's just dealt with so like matter-of-factly. It's like, okay, well, the little miceys eat the stringies off of his paws and then up he goes. Like,
it's just... Well, it's also the power of the animation. Like, I remember when I was a kid seeing it, this is, man, such a vivid memory. It's weird when those come back, where in the animation, the girls are trying to tear the mice off him because they think they're eating the corpse. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the danger of this. And then they realize, oh no, they're letting his bindings free. And it's just like, I'm sorry, I'm crying thinking about just how powerful that moment actually is and how soft it is in the movie. And it's, I'm getting upset here. I'm like, you fucked it up. Like, it's how do you mess up? You made it too soft.
I mean, I think, yes, it's one, it's Disney, and two, it's a different era that we grew up with. Like, when kids' movies were far more dangerous, right? And kids' movies were just like, you know, the age-old fables and folk tales that were meant to kind of teach you a lesson and not shy away from humanity. And it's all of its shades and flaws. But this one is just the Botox version of the film, even though it follows all of the plot structure of the book. Apparently, I watched something on YouTube where it's like, it's actually a faithful adaptation. But here's the thing. If you're faithful, you're not that faithful. This is the whole point. You know, the literary medium and the cinematic medium, they can get that. Sometimes those marriages don't work. It was all on paper, like Alicia said, and these ones don't work, right? Okay, so divorce, and after the third one, we get no conclusion, and kids don't learn a single thing from watching this.
I want to see the stop motion. I want to see stop motion Narnia. Is that possible? Yeah. Like, can Wes Anderson swoop in, get his like fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs guys and ladies and people and just like make the stop motion Narnia?
I mean, it's a different, I don't even care. Like, I don't care for these kids. I don't care for British kids in the 40s who come from a certain class. Like, if they were street kids and like.
You like plucky kids. You are not
I don't care for the middle class kids who just have so much naivete. And I did appreciate the attempt for the Cain and Abel between the brothers. Mm-hmm, that was interesting. And I do have to give credit to Tilda. When I did watch it, the moment when her eyes are completely black after the sacrifice
after
of the lions, let's give credit to the cameo appearances of Lord of the Ring villains and orcs that are in this. And it's like, you know, it's like where we have these awful CG animals, ferrets and raccoons.
It looks like the Lord of the Rings auditions. They were like, okay, you guys all made it into Lord of the Rings. And then you are the B team. We've got another film for you. You're not quite good enough for Lord of the Rings. You're not scary enough. So just come back tomorrow and we'll put you on Narnia.
Yeah.
We're going to give you bigger axes than swords so you can swing them a little slower. It's going
to
be fine.
But at the end of the day, these movies must be so hard to make. I have a lot of sympathy for the filmmaker. He was tasked with something so huge. And this was only his second film after Shrek. I mean, he didn't have the experience. Denis Villeneuve has been making movies for over 20 years to make Dune. And it was in his heart since he was a teenage boy, right? There was a calling, you know, Rob Reiner, when he's making a Stephen King adaptation, it's in his soul and he will bleed the movie and work as hard as he can for it.
But he was also those kids. Rob Reiner was that same age as that kids at that time, right?
That's it, right? That he identified with them. And for Andrew, he just... They took a shot and they tried and you don't
still
see
made
the
a ton of money. I mean, I know we were talking about this as a box office bomb. It wasn't. It, you know, it opened third. It made a lot of money, $1.5 billion across the three films worldwide. This was my sense of this film too is probably huge in Asia, probably huge in Europe. Like, I think there was maybe something that resounded more with that audience than with North American audiences.
And Becky, you have a kid, right? How old is your child? So have they seen this?
Honestly, I started to watch it with them and they got bored.
They
were
That's
not
it.
Into it. Fair enough.
Failed the test.
Now, have That's they ever had Turkish Delight?
No, they have not. However, they love jelly babies and whatnot, so I'm going to presume that there might be an
interest. You could take a little jelly baby and then roll it in some powdered sugar and call it Turkish Delight.
Here you go. We haven't. If I were to approach this story again with them, I would read them the book. I would not. I would not approach the adaptations.
The books are magical. This was, you know, I read these. It was kind of like Lord of the Rings light. If I read these at 10 and 11, and I remember getting like a hardcover set for Christmas and just enjoying them so much and then being able to work up then to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I don't think a lot of kids are reading The Chronicles of Narnia, even though there's that great SNL digital short. You know, Eastern, you want to talk about that? Your face just lit
no,
up.
No. I know nothing of Narnia and the digital short, but
it's Andy Samberg and was it Will Parnell? I can't remember who else is in its short. Neither of you remember this? The Chronicle, the rap Chronicles
I'll tell
of
you
Narnia?
What, I don't care about SNL the way I don't care about Narnia.
But this is 17 years ago, SNL, I think. Like, it's like,
Andy
not. Maybe
Samberg
it's a
17, it's crazy. Even thinking about 2005 is almost 20 years ago is insane.
Yeah. Like, this was, they probably did this short. This was like a really famous digital short, like the kind of beginning of Lonely Island doing like the best, like Dick in a Box. Like, it's that era. And there's one for Chronicles of Narnia where they get high and they go see Chronicles of Narnia. I feel like our listeners might know it. I hope.
Maybe I'll check it out. Later.
Short.
Send me a link later.
All right. Okay. With that having been said, I'm going to bring us into our next movie, which I think has the grit that this one is missing. We're going to be talking about the 2005 adaptation, as well as, yes, we're going to bring up the pig testicles like everybody else. That's coming up after the break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There are at least 17 different film and TV adaptations and interpretations of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, including modern riffs like Bridget Jones's Diary, the Bollywood-inspired Bride and Prejudice, and the frankly bananas Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, which I admit I have read, although I will not see the movie. The sexy will-they-or-won't-they story of Elizabeth Bennet, Fitzwilliam Darcy, and the Bennet and Bingley families is one that people love to see in various forms over and over again. And which is the definitive version is a hotly debated topic. Up for contention, though, is the 2005 version with Keira Knightley and Matthew McFadden as Elizabeth and Darcy. Eastern, do you have any love for the Bennets?
Oh, yeah, I can appreciate the Bennets. You know, I can especially appreciate the Bennets in this version, especially because of the depiction of the class differences. That are more obvious and apparent. You know, I'm a one of the people, you know, if I don't care for the filthy rich. Right. So there's something that I can really appreciate in this film, especially in the way that they're depicted. And we can go deeper into that.
All right. Well, before we get into that, if somehow someone has avoided a version of Pride and Prejudice at some point in their life, can you just give us a quick rundown of the plot, please?
I mean, the rundown of this plot, you got the Bennets, right? It's a family of, what, five daughters, and you got Mr. Mm-hmm. Bennet, yeah, and Mrs. Bennet. And this is an era in, well, depicted, I think, in the late 1790s, but the book was published in the 1813, around that time. Mm-hmm. So basically, you got the Bennets who live in the countryside, in the suburbs, and Mrs. Bennet desperately wants all her daughters married. And then here comes, what's his name, played by Simon Woods, Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy come into town, and they're like, uh-oh. You know, Mrs. Bennet's like, we got to hook you up with these boys. They're
let's get in
they're
there.
Rich. They're rich. We got to do them. Jane, my pretty one, you know, Elizabeth, my second prettiest one and the smart one. We got to.
Yeah, you've got skills.
So she starts pimping them. She's a mistress. She's a madame. Like, she's trying to hook them up with these guys because her daughters need to marry. If they don't.
Also, she's got nothing else to do.
There you go. She's got no.
Brenda Breslin, who's just lovely.
No Facebook, you know, yeah. no social media, no TV. This is her one obsession. And truly, she doesn't want them to ever meet spinsterhood. I get it. You know, and so what happens? Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy, there's a big town hall dance ballroom thing. And she tries to hook them up. And then Mr. Darcy is introduced to Elizabeth Bennet. This is what the whole movie's about. And at first, the first impressions are just lackluster. And there's a little bit of a beef and a tiff and an insult coming from Mr. Darcy. And that kind of makes him attractive in a way. Let's talk about that with women. Like, come on, you know, nice guys finish last. But then there's this thing where, you know, throughout the plot in the film, they kind of discover that they kind of like each other, and you kind of understand that Mr. Darcy actually really likes her. But you also learn that Mr. Darcy's really, really, really rich. And there's all this prejudice because there's this misconception of Mr. Darcy. So there's all this wonderful tension. There's this wonderful romantic tension, sexual tension, personal tension between the two throughout the drama of everyone trying to get married. And eventually this movie and book is a story about how to match the two right people perfectly. And, you know, sometimes they don't look like a match at first, but really deep down, they are a perfect match for each other. And I guess this is why the movie has stood the test of time. Mostly with women, dare I say? Come on, let's face it. Like, you know, like, this ain't the John Wick.
I would say gay men as well.
Gay men as well? Okay. Well, I mean, like, I appreciate it a lot. So I love Pride and Prejudice as a story. And I remember reading it in university and really digging the prose and really digging the social commentary throughout. And, you know, Jane Austen is not only witty and brilliant, but she just has a complete understanding of social politics, relationship politics, and
the world she's trapped in, and understanding the boundaries of those traps.
Exactly. And so why is this, you know, and I get it. Elizabeth Bennet is so amazing. Like, it's her soul and her wit and her rhythm and her thinking that makes her a complete person.
And everybody wants to be Elizabeth Bennet.
Do they?
Like, I'm sure if you ask most people, oh yeah, like, it's very much an iconic role. So Keira Knightley talking about taking this role, she almost didn't, because she was like, this is one of the most iconic roles in literature and people are going to be talking about it and me nonstop in this thing. This did get her first Academy Award nomination. And it's also hard to forget or remember, she's 20 mm-hmm. at this point. Like, you know, she was 16 when she did Bend It Like Beckham, and then her career just went bam.
And she's like 18 in Pirates of the Caribbean, right? Because like that, yeah. Pirates of the Caribbean preceded this, and that was kind of why this film got such great funding, is because she was bankable and not many other people in this film was. But I do know Joe Wright was very concerned in casting her simply because she was too pretty, and then he met her and was like, oh no, you'll do just fine. Because she's so awkward and sort of like, and it works for this character and her performance, is that of course she's stunningly beautiful, she has all the angles, but she kind of can, like, I don't know, she's able to retract that a little bit, and she's grubby and doesn't, you know, with the help of costume and hair and makeup, like, I get her as a tomboy in this, and it works really well.
On Cheap Trivia from IMDb, I read that Joe Wright made a rule and banned her from her trademark pouting. Mm-hmm. And so that I think helped. And I understand that he did feel, you know, I actually, that's my criticism of her as Elizabeth Bennet, is I do find her too pretty. But in hindsight, through Joe's, you know, direction and rules, I think they did pull it off because she was a charming Liz.
This is also, we should point out, the same year as Domino, where she played the real life bounty hunter, which is a completely different film. Tony Scott, like, very different. So, like, you're looking at these two different performances, with which she's good in Domino. It's not a great movie, but, like, what she is being asked to do, she does well. So it's interesting to see that she's also moving from these, like, high action swashbuckling things into these period dramas, which would then become her thing, right?
Yeah,
She's in Colette. We've had that on Hollywood Suite. I can't remember if it's in Window right now, but she is doing, like, you know, many years later. She's really kind of got her stronghold, like a foot in this like genre of independent Elizabeth Bennet-esque women who were either in real life or in the narrative completely ostracized and had to like break the bonds of patriarchy. Colette is a great example of that, about the author Colette and her incredible stories. But I liked her in this. This works for her. This is a great kind of text for Keira Knightley in period pieces.
No, I just think that to play Liz, it's a great feat. You have to be acrobatically, like, you know, you have to be a top athlete in the acrobatics of wit and acting and performance. And I agree that she does nail it. And I don't think just anybody could.
True.
I'm extremely biased because my favorite version of this is the BBC version with Colin Firth and Jennifer Eale. And Jennifer Lee Eale will always be my Elizabeth. I don't care who else plays her. But I mean, the difference between like a 6-part miniseries versus a like 90-minute film, like almost 2 hours, but like short, is you can't get in all those plot lines with all these characters you love. You can't spend the time, and you really have to choose your focus. And Joe Wright has very much focused on the romance and the social aspect between these two and who these characters are and why they don't connect, which I think is an interesting part of the story.
There's so much discussion of money, and I know that's from the book, obviously, like exact figures, and there's a lot of websites you can look at that do the translation or the conversion of like what their actual dowry would equal in today's dollars, what their income based on the investment on their estate would be. Like, it's kind of interesting, but I actually appreciated that about this version a little bit more than the BBC version, is that I could relate to it as someone who is not abundantly wealthy and is very concerned about housing and is very concerned about my future. And I find myself unmarriageable at the age that I am currently, so I can kind of relate.
Partner out the window.
Yeah, I've referred to myself as a incoming spinster, I believe, on this podcast in the past. But I got that. Like, I got that from this version. I love that. What I don't get from the BBC version and previous versions is everything, I think, Eastern, you kind of alluded to this, everything just seems, it's like monotonous because I just think everyone's rich and I don't get the nuance in the BBC version. But in here, you see that their house, the Bennet house, is reasonably sized, but it's covered in pig shit and it's falling apart and everything is dusty and they don't have a cook and they don't have a cleaning person. I think they do have a cook. But like,
It's specifically called out.
I get that from this version.
And I have to say, like, Joe Wright really nailed the mise-en-scene. He really nailed the costumes and the hair, especially, because I couldn't stop looking at the hair. It was greasy. It was not cool. It was just like, it was not prim. And then the moment that you go into the Bingley's estate or their country home, then you really see that shine.
Let's talk about Joe Wright's conscientiousness of that idea of class, because this was not someone who'd ever read the book before he had not read the book. The screenplay was his first introduction to the, he didn't read the book.
And he didn't watch
later.
The BBC series.
Really?
Nope, he kept everything fresh.
That's so funny.
So, but what one of the conscientious choices that he did do, which I think is interesting, is most people set this book in Edwardian England. So think about like the Empire dresses and like a little more of the prim and proper. That's not what he's doing. He's setting it in the late 1700s instead of late 1700s instead of the early 1800s. And the difference there is that the French Revolution had just happened. Yeah. And so England was going through a whole thing where they were like, oh shit, we better start being nicer to our lower classes, which is why Bingley and Bennet went to the party, and why they were slumming it.
Which is, it's all really interesting, because like you would think that that would get the Jane Austen Society very upset, and apparently they have major grievances with this film. But it makes sense, because it's the first draft of this story is 1797, so like she's writing it in 1797. That's where they set it. Whereas 1813, where the book, when she actually publishes it, which is much later when it's set, it's just a different context. And we don't really think about that 20 years in English history can be so, so different. But that's a great point, Becky, that French Revolution changed class structure, changed finances, changed political relations. It changed everything. So I think it's a brilliant move on the part of not just Joe Wright, but the screenwriter, Deborah Mogosh. I don't know if I'm saying, I think it's probably a very Gaelic last name that I'm kind of butchering. But her version of the story, which she worked on for a very long time, well before Joe Wright came to the project, that time travel is very smart.
And that, do we give her the credit for that time travel, or is it?
Yes, I believe so.
That's amazing. I think that, oh, wow, that informs
definitely
a lot.
Joe Wright was, I think, on it, because he points out that he doesn't, and I agree with him, like Empire waist dresses are very unflattering. The only character you see wearing one is the character of Carolyn Bingley, played by Kelly Riley, because they would have assumed that she's so rich that she would have been wearing fashions a solid decade or 15 years before they became commonplace. But it's really hard to photograph Empire waist because it makes women it takes all curves out. It's just straight up and down. It's a very hard silhouette to pull off, even for, you know, impossibly thin women. So he really just wanted more flattering, earthy, organic dress shapes. And so that was a natural 1797 decision.
The other thing that they've done too here is they brought in Emma Thompson as an uncredited and, as far as we can tell, unpaid script doctor. And watching it, I was like, okay, these are interesting points I've never seen people make, especially about the societal stuff. For example, Charlotte explaining to Elizabeth why she's marrying Mr. Collins, because in the book it's just assumed, like, Lizzie doesn't get it because Lizzie has the privilege of not having to get it.
I've no money and no prospects. I'm already a burden to my parents. And I'm frightened. So don't judge me, Lizzie. Don't you dare judge me.
And that part was written by Emma Thompson. So it's like, okay, I get it. And she, of course, had won her Academy Award, one of her many Academy Awards, for writing for Sense and Sensibility, which I think is one of the best adaptations.
Absolutely.
To both cover the romance and cover the societal stuff. Like, she's really great at the combination of the two. So I think her little added things of, like, people need to get this because they're not going to get it now, so it needs to be explained a little bit.
She also wrote the great sequence where Elizabeth is realizing her sister has run off with that that womanizer. I can't remember
Wickham.
His name.
With Wickham.
Yeah, sorry, Wickham. And it's that scene where she's just walking around in a circle. She, like, goes behind the wall. She comes out. She can't even get it out of her mouth to her uncle and aunt and Darcy. And, like, I love that scene. So it's like this little merry-go-round or this carousel of despair. And I think it's such a wonderfully choreographed scene. And so learning that that was Emma Thompson, I'm like, of course it was.
I mean, Joe Wright, he just simply knows how to shoot a film. He just knows how to play.
This is his first film. Like, he had done television film.
Yeah.
Work really impressively with this period, but this is his first feature theatrical film, and I don't think I knew that going into this film. That's really remarkable. It makes sense to me because I'm a huge fan of Atonement, and that is, I think, a really effective book adaptation. I love that book.
The first 40 minutes of Atonement is literally the first 40 pages of the book, perfectly done. Let's just put that out there.
But it works.
Oh,
I mean, it really works.
Perfectly.
Saoirse Ronan morphing into Romola Garai, like all of that. I'm just like, this is wondrous.
The first 40 minutes of that movie, I just got to put it out there, is perfect clockwork. We're talking a Rolex or a Patek Philippe watch, like, perfect.
I'm going to bring a watch brand.
I've been watching a bunch of YouTube videos on watches for no good
no,
reason.
No, we really do actually need a watch like sponsorship on this podcast.
Oh, that'd be nice. I think a couple things that I would love to mention based off of that is, what was it? Sorry, Mr. Collins. You brought up Mr. Collins, so I got to just go there. Whoever that actor is.
Oh, dude, Tom Hollander? Have you seen In the Loop?
No. Oh, wait. I did long ago, I think.
You know Tom Hollander. He looks really different.
He was so familiar. Yeah. He steals the show. And every once in a while, you watch a decent film. It doesn't have to be great. It could be bad. There's one person who just comes right in and just, like, owns everyone in this scene and just captivates me. And that performance there.
That proposal. The proposal scene.
His eye,
laughing.
His lack of blinking, and just his just trying, just attempting at navigating at trying to get married in this game of trying to get wed, was just hilarious and beautiful.
But before I run away with my feelings, perhaps I may state my reasons for marrying. Firstly, that it is the duty of a clergyman to set the example of matrimony in his parish. Secondly, that I am convinced it will add greatly to my happiness. And thirdly, that it is at the urging of my esteemed patroness, Lady Catherine, that I select a wife.
And that's, I think, another thing that makes this story so universal, as well as Sense and Sensibility. You know, Ang Lee adapted Sense and Sensibility. Like, what the hell does he have to do with British families from the 1800s? He had claimed apparently everything. And that as coming from a Taiwanese family, he completely relates to the pressures of trying to get married and trying to hook up and all these things. And at the end of the day, what is the universal thread that we all relate to when we read Jane Austen or watch Pride and Prejudice is that we're afraid of being alone. And that's the thing. It's like, that's what the mom is hustling for. It's like, I don't want you to be 50 and alone. That's fucked. And it goes back to Mr. Collins and who ends up marrying. What's her name again? Like,
Charlotte.
You know, and I was convinced by Charlotte. I was like, yo, Liz, like,
she has a nice house now and I'm happy for her.
Yeah.
And her husband's
and then obviously,
stupid,
and
but
obviously they
her.
Don't have sex, right? Yeah. There is no expectation of it. So one of the modern readings of that character is that Charlotte is gay. So it doesn't matter who she would end up with, she would just wouldn't be happy.
And did you say that's
it.
Because
so
she's beyond childbearing years or because her husband is a priest?
No. They would still have sex and like that was, but like at no point, because like in the way the time period of the book works, if they were going to have children, they would have been having children, right? Like she would have been pregnant when Elizabeth goes to visit her. That's not what happened.
Unless
so clearly infant. Their relationship is.
I mean, okay. I buy it.
The interpretation is their relationship is asexual.
I buy it because it was just absolutely asexual. There was no, and she wasn't even going to give him a chance. She was like, no, I'm here. I'm just like, we're just going to do this.
She has her, I love when she's like, this is my own room for my own purposes. He's not allowed to come in here. We can say anything we want to each other. And she's like pouring. I'm like, man, I live in a like tiny two-bedroom apartment. I need a room. I need a room like that. I need
a room of one's own. My wife, Sylvia, she's actually reading A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf. And she's going through the whole thing where it's like, the prose is weird. And this, and by page 40, she's like, absolutely, I need my own room. And look at this thing that she wrote about Shakespeare. You like women
it.
Need this freedom that like men get to, you know, have. And so, yeah, I'm glad that she got her own room.
Our listeners can't see that as he's saying this, he's looking through the door to make sure she can't hear.
And he's pointing at
that. That was subconscious, funny. But like, I love it.
All right. I have read many, many Jane Austen novels over and over again. And I'm so on the fence about this adaptation. I appreciate what it is and what it's doing and the point of view it's doing. I don't buy the romance in this movie. I don't buy the chemistry, and I don't know why. I don't find it sexy. And I think there's an interesting thing in that this movie actually has two endings, one for the UK market and one for the American market.
Which is so
stupid.
And
the UK, it's so stupid. And Joe Wright tried to fight it and unfortunately couldn't. But the US market, the UK one ends with like a little witty quip of like the two of them kind of like together. And then the US version ends with the two of them in freaking 16 candles where they're like next to each other. And like, yeah, it's 16 candles. It's really,
I watched
rough.
Both. I mean, I watched the US version on Prime and any streaming version of this film. And when we've shown this film on Hollywood Suite, we get the US version. There is no option for the other version. And so I actually thought that's the only ending, and I hate that ending. And then I went on YouTube, you can watch the UK version, and it's ethereal, and the mist is coming in, and it's dark, and it's brooding, and it's very British, and it's almost more Bronte than Austen, that like ending.
Yeah.
Which, as I think we've talked in this podcast, that I'm team Bronte.
Team Bronte, I mean, versus team Austen. I know
makes the relationship so great between Liz and Darcy is that it's not that juicy romantic 16 candles in the first place.
It's intellectual.
It's the vibe. It's like there. It's just there.
And my issue with this is when you introduce this kind of grit and this kind of realism and the focus is on the money, etc. I found some of the wit was taken away, and I found some of the magic and the romance and the playfulness was taken out.
I think there's real despair in this, though. Like what I'm getting from this version that's not in the other versions is like the stakes are a lot higher because these daughters, if they don't marry, are only getting, what is it, like 500 a year or something? I can't remember.
Yeah. However, that having been said, they cut all the Wickham plot line with Lydia almost entirely, which is the highest stakes climax moment. And you need to understand why they are so fucked because she ran off with Lydia.
Like the whole the family reputation will be ruined.
When you watch that's the thing with the miniseries is because you have this breath for the passage of time. So you can see how long they're gone, how they cannot find them. Like they're found immediately in this one. It's like, oh yeah, uncle found him. It's fine. So like you have this, like how long they have to sit in the fact that no one is ever going to marry them and they are screwed.
Yeah.
And you sit in that a lot longer. Here you don't. Here it's like, oh, found him. Everything's fine. And you know, and Lydia shows up and is a bit of an idiot.
I mean,
which
I get
she
that
is.
Because I don't want to watch a 3-hour version of this film. And this film's 2 hours.
It's 6 hours. You don't have to sit through it.
But I will say, I mean, I get what you're saying about the chemistry and the romance. I had not seen this film when it came out. I know Mr. Darcy, Matthew McFadden, solely for Succession.
You also notice this is the only time we have brought him and his performance up.
Because he's not Darcy.
Yeah, but I don't think Darcy. That's right. I did you hate him? I loved him as Darcy.
No, he's an all right Darcy, but like then I watched the BBC and the first two minutes with Colin Firth, I was like, that's the Darcy I know.
It's hard. Yeah, that's a hard follow-up.
He shows up in a wet shirt and the UK lost their minds and needed to declare a national holiday. Like, he's so attractive. It's ridiculous.
But what if this film is for a different generation that are way younger than us and do not give a flying fuck about the BBC Colin Firth version?
This, for me, is that version. This is the version that is not for Jane Austen fans.
No.
This is the version to introduce Austen for people who don't like Austen. Which is why I think you like this version.
Could it be? So the interesting thing about it is the BBC obviously is rewarded by the fact that it's 6 episodes and it's long. We know that in its length, it can breathe and it can build and then the stakes can feel higher and the rewards will feel more like fulfilled, right? Through that character development. And you didn't really feel the love because we were going through a tempo and a rhythm that was like a metronome that Joe Wright was working towards. I think he intentionally went, I need to make this a certain pace. And you could feel that pace throughout where it's quick, 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 but very measured. So it's not like the pace works for the film, but it may not work for the story of Pride and Prejudice, the book, which works better in BBC. And so therefore the payoff may not feel fulfilled for you, but it may feel better for the 15-year-old girl watching it from South Korea, watching it in 2010, because
which is interesting, because then when I think about the features where the movies have, or where the romance has worked for me in a feature, and I Sense and Sensibility, the scene where Edward tells Eleanor that he isn't married, and she realizes what that means, and I mean, it's the performance of Emma Thompson in that movie is unbelievable, but you cry too, and you're so moved, you're like, thank fucking God he can now marry you, and he's not going to be an idiot and do the wrong thing, right? Like, you get that breath there, and here, I never got that breath. It's same thing in I love Patricia Rosema's Mansfield Park, and there's a movie that goes gritty, right? It goes into the sex. There's lots of naked people. It goes into who and how evil these other people are, and
it's the only slavery in it,
100%. And you know, the uncle who's been so good to her is a nightmare human, right? And you're just like, holy shit. But that's another movie where it doesn't make it about the romance, but the romance still feels real.
That's fair. I mean, I do see, though, thinking this is 2005, think about like what the biggest adaptations of Jane Austen would have been up to this point in that, let's say the decade up to this point. Clueless, Bridget Jones's Diary, Bride and Prejudice, the Bollywood, like, this, I appreciate that Joe Wright really was bringing Austen back to its authenticity. Where I think we have a problem, Becky, is you're the worst audience for this film possible. And the only reason I chose this film really is because of you, trying to make you happy. And I'm realizing that I've done a huge disservice because nothing will ever make you happy when it comes to Jane Austen. You are completely insatiable and hard to please.
But you...
Thank you, Alicia.
I mean that all as a compliment, of course.
I'm well aware.
And when you take a look at the comments on YouTube, like the girls, people are saying that Matthew McFadden is their Mr. Darcy. So it's a generation.
They are. And everybody's going to have this. I'm here for that because I love that he then graduated into Tom Wamsutt in Succession, the biggest buffoon. Like, I just think he's such a fascinating actor. And watching his anniversary interviews for this film, where he talked about, like, the reaction of young girls, because he was an unknown. Will give one thing. That little hand flex, there's been much made of it online.
It's when he holds
her hand to put her. Elizabeth's getting into the carriage, and he goes to, like, kind of do the gentlemanly thing, take her hand and help her into the carriage. And there's a moment between them where their hands are touching, and it's that first spark. And then as he walks off, Joe Wright closes in on his hand, and his hand, I'm doing it for Eastern in the video, which was
I remember this scene now. I actually remember.
And he goes like this, like he's walking away like, yeah. Oh my God, I can't handle it.
I just touched her. Yeah.
I love it. I love it so much.
I tell you what, that scene, yes, I remember that scene. I remember noting, oh, Joe, you're good at this. Like you catch those little.
Joe is lusty. Joe's a lusty man. He understands.
He then proceeded to have a relationship with Jane Bennett, Rosamund Pike, for like the next four or five years,
dude,
I believe.
Did you guys know trivia, IMDb cheat trivia? Did you know that the guy who played Mr.
They were
Beauty?
Dating.
Was dating that 2 years ago and their exes. That's great. But can we go back to the hand? That is.
Yes, of course.
That is what makes cinema different from all other arts. Time, space, image, no words, a close up.
The capture of a moment. Capture,
a split second. It's a really
capture
a split
of
second.
Like, I'm getting goosebumps, you guys. A capture of a moment where he's so nervous, right? I felt that when in the BBC, when Liz is going to the Bingleys and is walking in her dirty boots and surprises Colin Firth Darcy, and he goes, oh shit. Like, I thought that moment was not as equal to that, but that's a moment where he's like, oh fuck. He probably was thinking about Liz that whole day.
Yeah, catching him off guard.
And then she caught him off guard. And it's like, just relating to that moment would be precious of a moment for anyone. You know, so, they're both good Darcys, but I will vote for Colin Firth as the one.
And that's fair. Okay. I'm just saying this is, it's in some ways comparing apples and oranges. I don't think it's a fair comparison.
No, let's not even compare it, because let's talk about the apple and the orange, because the Colin, the Colin Firth Darcy, like, this is not a new opinion. It's like, he's just more snobby. Right. He really has this whole he's the prejudice. Right. He's full of it and full of the pride. And then the other one by what's his name? McFadden?
Matthew McFadden.
McFadden. Yeah. He's the bumbly one. He's the socially awkward one.
And I think
Joe did go for that. And so they really are apples and oranges. And choose your Darcy. Right. Do you like the cute, handsome, hunky, kind of humble?
Can I sleep with one and marry the other?
Then who do we kill,
dude,
Mr. Collins? Like,
yeah, no, yes, yeah, sleep with McFadden, but marry Firth.
Yeah, no, I'd go the other way around. Okay, I'd rather not distinguish why.
Okay. All right.
Have either of you seen the Laurence Olivier version?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. Okay. I won't even bother with that.
It's Greer Garson, right?
Olivier is quite a snob. So yeah, maybe he would. How is he?
It's the same year as Rebecca. So I mean, if you think about that year, and Olivier's like playing a rich asshole.
He is sexy as AF in that movie. He's got the tight trousers going.
He's super sexy Rebecca too.
Really?
Yeah, of course he is.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. On that note, I have to end this episode because we are going over time. So who knew? Who knew we would all get so excited about this? All right. So Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I would like to – I'm probably going to go out and get some Turkish delight. I want to give it another try. I feel like I'm mature enough maybe to really dive into this. And I look forward to spinsterhood.
Stop. Hey, listen. No, stop saying that. No, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
There's a Korean cooking show my partner and I love to watch where they talk about the difference between an adult taste and a child taste.
Oh.
And that they'll say something has a child taste. And like that makes, and usually that means it's like extra sweet or like it's super saucy or whatever, versus an adult taste, which tends to be more subtler. So we use that all the time. And so that's what I think. Perhaps now you have
an adult
taste.
That's a really great distinction, because it also explains why I eat so many goldfish crackers.
There you go. A child taste.
Thank you, Ben.
Eastern, you're welcome. Eastern, you, thank you so much for joining us for the first time. I'm sure it will not be the last.
Oh, I passed the test. Thank you, Becky.
You more than passed the test.
It's an honor and a pleasure as always, Alicia and Becky. We had two adaptations. both one succeeded better than the other, but even in the success of Pride and Prejudice, it's still weird. It's a best of hits, right? So, you know, how do you make a perfect
still
adaptation?
Still room for improvement.
How do you make a perfect adaptation?
It's hard.
Can I ask you that question? What is the perfect adaptation? But for the movie for you, it was High Fidelity.
The perfect High Fidelity. You know what? I think the perfect adaptation is Misery. I think Misery is the perfect adaptation.
Amazing. Alicia?
That's a good... I mean, mine was Bram Stoker's Dracula. I'm sticking with that.
Yeah.
I can't, and I know that's an atypical one, but, you know, we do have a show coming up on Hollywood Week called Cinema A to Z, and we have a whole episode on books, which
there
you will
go.
See Eastern talking about books. You'll see Becky talking about Jane Austen, including Mansfield Park and Sense and Sensibility.
Yes!
And so we're very invested actually right now in book adaptations, and that's been a really fun exercise. And I know reading has gotten me through this pandemic in a big way. And I would say 50% of what I read is just based on what's being adapted for film or for television or has been in the past. That's just kind of like really molding what I choose to pick up.
Yeah. And finally, Eastern, do you want to tell us where people can hear more of your voice and see your face and check out what you're talking about?
I mean, I got nothing set up right now. You guys were able to help me like finally bring confidence into podcasting. And so I think this is the debut. And who knows? I know I'm going to be naming it Eastern Promises because I used to program Asian cinema at the Royal. And I will expand beyond Asian cinema because there's way more in cinema that I cannot not talk about. Shoot, we'll see when that comes out. We'll see.
I'm very excited.
We'll keep you posted, listeners. All right. And you can join us next week, of course, for our final episode of the season where we will be watching Wolf Creek and The Proposition. They're awesome. They're both fantastic movies. They're just difficult watches. But, you know, we've got a lot to say about them. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Alicia Fletcher and Eastern Yu as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.